good faith security researchers. That's the term. Best faith security researchers. I'm gonna put that in my Twitter bio now. Best faith security researcher.
Hey everybody, how's it going? TechnoGeek here. I just wanted to take a moment to shout out our episode sponsor, Project Discovery. Project Discovery makes a lot of different hacking tools. I'm sure you've at least heard of Nuclei, and that's the one we wanted to focus on today. They just released version 3.2. Now, 3.2 has a ton of awesome new features, and the two I wanted to highlight are authenticated scanning and the changes to fuzzing support. Now, authenticated scanning does basically what you'd expect. You can finally now authenticate into applications automatically with Nuclei. You can leverage either the built-in existing login templates that they've included, or you can make your own, and you can use all of your old existing Nuclei templates to scan on an authenticated context within an application now. For fuzzing support, they have now expanded the fuzzing from just query parameters all the way out to headers and cookies and body parameters and paths and everything that you can imagine. So you're going to want to check out what's in this new release. Again, it's version 3.2. And if you want to learn more, go to nux.gg/podcast. Again, that's nux.gg/podcast. Thanks.
Dude, why is there a link in this doc of a mobile device server rack? why did you put this in here? What is this?
Okay, so you asked me yesterday, you were like, hey, do you have any interesting links? Like, do you use Twitter bookmarks? And I was like, I do use Twitter bookmarks, but I don't think I have anything useful in there. And I opened it up, and the last thing I'd bookmarked was this post that I saw. And I just found it really interesting. So I think the original thread was sort of like going through the evolution of like how sort of this phone automation stuff has developed over the last, you know, decade or whatever. And it used to be that you'd have like a real person sitting in front of like a sheet of plywood with 15 cheap Samsung phones on it or whatever, and they would just like tap all the buttons on like 30 different screens.
Dude,
and,
talk about the most boring job. That was just ever. How it worked. Like, you just get a message and you're like, all right, like this post on like 50 different devices, and then you just go around and tap. It's crazy.
Exactly. So, but the one that I liked was this, I think it's like the latest generation or whatever, but like, I'd never seen anything like this. They take real phones and they disassemble them and they unscrew the main board from inside the device. And then they hook it up to some special PCB that they developed. And they do this like 20 times and they mount them inside of a server case so that there's like 15 of these boards just like sitting on their edge, just like mounted next to each other, all plugged into this one giant board. And then you take like a single USB cable from this box and you plug it into your computer and you run this software and you just have like a display of like, you know, the 30 screens from every single phone that's mounted inside the server box.
Virtualized,
and you just click once and it clicks
like,
everywhere.
Yeah, I love how it clones it to all of them, but it looks like, you know, they're just doing Android virtualization, but it's like actual physical devices.
Yeah, it's super, super interesting. But I guess this is how they're doing it nowadays with all the big like bots, botnet type of things
or whatever. And
yeah. And I was saying like back in my day, so before I'd gotten to Bug Bounty and stuff, I used to write bots. And the way that I did this was I just had like a stack of iPhones that I bought on eBay that I jailbroke. Just like sitting on the floor.
You were the guy with the giant piece of plywood and pressing the buttons, huh?
That's exactly right.
That's hilarious, dude. I bet that was a pretty relevant hacking experience, though, building bots for you know, things, let's just say.
Yeah, I like it's very, very similar skill set to Bug Bounty, just like different implementation is like how I like to see it.
Still got to reverse engineer stuff.
I think that there's a lot of... Exactly. It's like that same sort of mindset. Like I would say security is a mindset where like hacking is a mindset where you just have to reframe how you think about like the same sort of problems. And I think that's a great example of it where like botting and security are like almost identical. It's just how you decide to like use the information that you have, whether you choose to like exploit it for malicious purposes or whether you choose
there's
to like
a huge overlap of the community too. So many really talented botters or anti-botters have gone into security afterwards. This is an interesting pipeline.
Yeah,
and vice versa
as
well. I've seen people go from security and hacking into the anti-bot space and be like, wow, this is so hard, you know? So
Yeah, exactly. Every once in a while I get nerd sniped into that area again.
That's probably one of the more, I don't know, I imagine that's one of the more sort of back and forth industries that you've got, because like security is a little bit back and forth. Like sometimes you'll actively be like, oh, this person's literally trying to hack my website right now, or like my computer right now. But like those are kind of rare. But with botting stuff, I mean, it's like, are they gonna bot this drop or not, you know? Like, and the answer is always going to be pretty much yes, you know? So they're always going to be trying to figure out how to get around it, and it's probably one of the more tangible cat and mouse games you can find in IT.
For sure. It's a really big cat and mouse game. Like that was the biggest thing that sort of like pulled me away from it. It was just like, it was very grindy in that sense, where like it's you versus the security team. And in my opinion, the security team always has an advantage, because from the attacker's perspective, they have to reverse engineer how all these different checks work. From the security team's perspective, they can implement like 10 checks and turn on one of them and then, you know, let it sit. And then the hacker figures out, okay, this is how I bypass one of them. And then the security team turns on a second one. And then
anti-botting thing under the security team normally? Do you know? Is that like its own division, or is it like a...
Yeah, I mean, usually it's either under security or like trust and safety type stuff, because they're usually like sort of hand in hand with like anti-fraud, anti-botting, that type of...
Interesting. Yeah. Well, this is the last time I'm letting you put a link in the doc, Joel. I had to open this up, and it's just like a server rack full of mobile phones. The most Joel thing I could possibly think of.
Yeah, wait till you see what I bookmarked next month.
That's great, man. All right, dude. Major life lesson here for any of those listening, and for you and for me. When Shubs tweets something, you listen to the tweet. I'm a simple man. When Shubs tweets, I listen, you know? And Shubs tweeted out earlier this week about, as he said, let me just read what he said. I can't believe so many people are sleeping on this research. Here's the link. And when he says something like that, you got to not sleep on that, because that's serious. And lo and behold, I took the deep dive. I read it, and he is correct. We were fast asleep on this whole, or at least I was. Yeah. I was fast asleep on this .NET remoting research that just came out from Code White.
Yeah. So it's interesting, because most of the time when the Asset Note team or Shubs is tweeting about something, it's some zero day that they've either reverse engineered or found, and they have like a big blog post. This was different. This was just like a blog post. And not only that, it was like a month old. It was, it wasn't like, oh, this came out 3 days ago. Like when he says sleeping, like this had been out for maybe
Shubs.
Over a month.
Next time tweet it out, about a month, tweet that out right away as soon as it comes out. Just be like, hey, this is amazing. Everyone should look at this. But yeah,
it's super, super interesting. And what's cool is it's not even the first one in this sort of like series. Like the Code White had done another blog post 2 years ago in 2022 about this same sort of technology from sort of a different perspective. And it's called .NET remoting. Mm. So I know that I popped something with it last night. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about that, because I think we have something special for the listeners too.
So there's a lot of cool things, cool takeaways from this one. I'm going to give a high level overview of what this sort of concept is here. And then we'll kind of go into the new research that just came out. So .NET remoting is essentially, if you guys are familiar with Java, RMI, remote method invocation, it's very similar to that. But essentially, it allows you to call functions and expose objects, let me be more clear, to your code on a different server. And it runs that code on that server rather than in your local code base. And so you can register these various classes to be able to be triggered remotely. And then you have the ability to call those classes over TCP, IPC, or HTTP. And so there's a couple resources. We'll create a section in the show notes on the best resources I could find on this that got me up to speed on it enough to pop an RC last night or multiple RCs last night. But and essentially, you know, you have those three ways of exploiting it. And but the problem was previously, before this research came out, in order to exploit this over HTTP, which is the one that has the least, you know, security controls on it and the one that is most likely to be exposed due to HTTP services often being exposed, you needed to know this like arbitrary string in the URL that gets generated when these objects get created. And if you know this arbitrary string, then you can access that interface and get it to run, instantiate these objects and run code. Yeah.
Got it.
So the problem then is, how do we get this URL? And that is what this amazing research that Shubs highlighted and Marcus Wolf Tang, I hope I pronounced that correctly, was writing about when he released this leaking object references to exploit HTTP.NET remoting article back on February 27th. And essentially what this does is it takes advantage of some error stack trace dump that happens when you cause an error in this flow. And that stack trace, if the conditions are correct, will leak this URL that you need, this super important URL. And so there's a couple ways that he did that. And of course, he's building on the back of some research by the IIS GOAT, Mr. Sarush himself, in some research that he posted. Man, when did Sarush post this research? I want to say this was 2019, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. 2019. Yeah, March of 2019. Yeah.
And essentially, there is a trusted, and you know, when I say this, it just feels so good to say it, man. There is a trusted object that you can overwrite in the HTTP request by setting a header, right? So what Sarush found was that you can set the underscore underscore request verb header when you're sending an HTTP request, okay. And that will override the request verb that is in that is the trusted request verb object in the HTTP so request object inside of the IIS stuff being processed in the .NET processing of the HTTP requests. And what that does is that creates a mismatch between, okay, you send a GET request and then you set the header so it thinks it's a POST request. And then that causes some error, which will, in certain situations, dump that URL, that object reference URL that will leak that you are that super special URL that you need access to actually do this .NET remoting thing. And then from there, he provides the team over at CodeWhite provides this awesome GitHub repo. I don't know. Did I put it in the doc? Find it right now. I'll put it in the doc. But they have this awesome GitHub repo that just makes it super simple to go and exploit this. And it's in this like little note at the end of the it's literally the last line of the article. It says, we also released this GitHub repo, HTTP remoting object ref leak with additional resources such as a vulnerable web app and some example exploit payloads and a script for automated object ref leaking and payload delivery. Dude.
And there's just a Python script in here. It's literally less than 100 lines. And it's just like... Yeah,
dude, I awesome. Love that. And I messaged Marcus on Twitter and I said, dude, thank you for being so thorough with this write-up and then also delivering, you know, like a beautiful exploit to GitHub. And thank you also for putting it at the very end of this article so that most people will skip it if they get intimidated by this article. And then only I will find it. And then I will use it to pop bugs. Cause that's what happened last night. Cause I hit Nogly up. I was like, all right, I understand this research. Scan for this, scan for that. And he ran, you know, a scan across his whole, you know, empire of subdomains or whatever. And we got a couple hits and we popped some RCs. So
that's so awesome. That's so awesome. And what's cool is, so at the very end, initially, this actually didn't have a CVE. This was just like some research that was just published in a blog back in February. And a week ago, a little under a week ago, Microsoft reassessed it and they published a CVE for it. And it was addressed in the January, the CVE was addressed by updates in January 2024, but the CVE was omitted from the security updates. So I am wondering if that maybe is how Shubs picked up on this, because this was on March 22nd when the CVE was released by Microsoft, and maybe the team over there is just keeping a close eye on.
But Shubs
on
is also Microsoft
CVEs or something like that.
Yeah, I feel like Shubs is also like a shark with this stuff. So like anytime anything IIS or .NET related, you know, comes up, he's like, shoo. You know, it's like a piranha in the water, you know, to those sort of things. Sorry to represent you that way, Shubs, but it's like, I mean, he knows all the things about IIS related stuff and .NET related stuff. So any of that Windows HTTP stack thing. So I wouldn't be surprised if he was on top of this as soon as it came out.
Yeah, I do love how much like sort of, it's not necessarily new research, right? Like it is, but it isn't. Like the core research itself is, but a lot of the stuff that is based on like the blog from Sarush, for example, that blog is now 5 years old from the NCC group one from Sarush, and talking about this same sort of technology. That even their previous blog post from CodeWhite was 2 years old. So it's really interesting. I mean, we talked about this over and over again that just because something is a couple years old research-wise doesn't mean that it's out of date or irrelevant or not applicable. And taking the time to read through those research, even if it's, you know, 5 years old, you see something 5 years old and you're like, oh, well, this probably won't apply today. It probably does, actually, and you should read through
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. And I always love when people continue to build on their past research, because, you know, the CodeWhite team at this point, after having done this in what did you say, 2 years ago, so 2022, you know, they have a knowledge set on this topic that is, you know, very exclusive to them and maybe a couple other people in the world, you know? And so they are carrying the burden of like, all right, if there's going to be innovation in this area, it should probably be me, you know? And they continue to build upon that research and build upon that research until they find a way like this to leak these object references and get access to that secret URL. Very cool. I really like it.
Yeah. Super, super cool. Awesome. Should we go to the next link?
Yeah, hit me with it, man.
Okay. So this is a fun one. This doesn't happen almost ever. There was a DOM purify bug. Dude. So this is always juicy because I woke up a couple of days ago and somebody in one of our mutual group chats had posted. It was like, babe, wake up. The new DOM purify bypass just dropped. And I was like, whoa, that's crazy. And this is a really, really cool blog from what's her name? I literally just had it open. Slonser.
Yeah, that's it.
Slonser, both on Twitter and their blog, Slonser _. And their blog is blog.slonser.info. So essentially, this is a bit of a niche bypass. The main thing here is that it has to do with passing in element object into the DOM purify sanitize function. So you can both pass in a string that is just like HTML and it will sanitize that, or you can pass in an actual object reference. Like if you do like document.createElement, you can pass that actual variable into DOM purify sanitize and it'll do the same thing. And one of the interesting things that he noticed is that when it basically back parses or forward parses, whatever, it converts it into a string or from a string into the actual element nodes, it checks the types of the elements and does certain processing on every single one. And there, it has the capability to sanitize and parse XML as well as HTML. And there are some core key differences between XML and HTML when it's getting parsed and when it's getting rendered by the browser and individually. And so what this researcher found is that if you pass in these special XML tags, you know how XML has like the open arrow question mark and it does like open arrow question mark and sets the, you know, what version it is.
There's a couple weird tags in XML, right? There's like the ones we use for XXE all the time, the C data ones. And then there's also, these are like, these are processing instruction tags, right?
Right. Yeah. So they're referred to specifically as processing instructions, and you can basically think of them as sort of like metadata that really just tells the processor how it's, you know, processor instructions, right? It tells it how it should be processed rather than, you know, directly just sort of inferring a lot of that stuff. And so DOM Purify has to handle this. And the way that it does handle this is by essentially replacing those tags with HTML comment tags. Right? And so you have a little bit of a confusion here where it's going from XML to HTML in the rendering, in the sanitization process, where it's sort of passively just say, oh, this should be treated as HTML. But as we've mentioned, there are core differences between how XML and HTML are both interpreted and rendered by the browser. So when you put this stuff inside of like an SVG tag, for example, you can do all sorts of really fun things. And the TLDR is that if you open with these processing instructions and then you just leave an empty closing arrow or closing, you know, bracket in there or whatever, it doesn't properly sanitize it. And so it allows you to escape that into an HTML context, and you can insert, you know, image elements that trigger on error and all that kind of stuff. They're just directly within the SVG. Not within the SVG, outside of the SVG. It lets you break out of the SVG. Yeah, super, super interesting. And I think part of the root cause, at least in the beginning, was the fact that when it filters through the element nodes that you feed into the sanitize function, it has selectors for specific types. Like, should it allow comments? Should it allow elements? Should it allow processing instructions? And processing instructions was not enabled by default. And so what, you know, it caused it to sort of have this behavior where it wasn't handling it correctly. It was handling it in a very specific way, as if it was like HTML. And so that was the initial fix. And then I think that there was actually a bypass just based on sort of like how DOM Purify is configurable. You can have these different checks that look for different tag names and stuff. And you can, again, you can bypass it using a similar sort of, you know, you use a custom tag name and you do the same sort of attack where you close it early and you can get it to, you know, pull this custom data out of the elements and again, trigger
using a custom tag name instead of the processing instructions for, okay, gotcha.
Yeah. It uses this. Yeah. It has this like special custom element handling configuration thing. And one thing I will note is, I think they actually mentioned this as well. This isn't super common, like the configuration and the use case here, but it is still a bypass and it's still really, really interesting data. And I think you actually mentioned that, we won't name them, but somebody that you know, yeah, and dude, I know, I managed to find some bypasses.
I did get permission. So Uriotak, I guess is his handle, but Uriota is his name. He saw this and he's, you know, just the brain just starts spinning and spinning and spinning. So he actually found some bypasses to this as well. So this is, you know, one, a bypass, then another bypass and a fix. And then Uriota also has some bypasses. So this processing instructions thing seems to have been the core of a lot of really tricky functionality as far as HTML parsing goes and HTML sanitization goes. So I bet in other libraries, there's also similar problems if they're also including HTML or XML with the HTML when they're trying to do the sanitization. So definitely some cool takeaways there. And the processing instruction thing, I wasn't familiar with this. I didn't think until I realized that, the processing instruction that you see at the beginning of every single XML blob, you know, like if you're going to do an XXE, it's his like, you know, angle bracket, question mark,
yeah,
XML,
arrow, question mark,
yeah, and it like
XML.
Defines that this is like an XML document, and you can define like the UTF-8 or whatever.
Encoding and stuff.
And so you see it almost all the time. I just hadn't really been like, oh, what is that yet? So I'm glad for people like Slonser that are think, oh, what is that? And go research it and find cool stuff like this, because this is definitely a really sweet bypass.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe something for the listener. I do wonder how this works for other things. Like PHP, I think, is a great example, which also does a similar thing, where it has those sort of like processing, not really processing instructions, but like that prefix type of stuff. And perhaps other similar instances of this behavior may also be vulnerable to bad implementations or like weird tricky situations like this where you can feed double tags and get it to parse.
Yeah, for
parse
sure, weird. Dude. I'm looking forward to seeing Yota's write-up. He's going to release it within the next couple of weeks, so I'm excited for that bad boy.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah, I love it's awesome. I mean, the Cure 53 team, in the blog, it says that they fixed it like same day.
Always.
I mean, like almost immediately. So super cool. I think we know at least one person over on that team who's doing really cool stuff. So shout out to the Cure 53 team. Shout out to Dom Purify. Super awesome. Even when they make a little mistake, they address it very elegantly.
Yeah, as much as I love the Dom Purify team, man, it hurts me on a weekly basis to see their tool properly implemented in so many places. It's like, no, it's Dom Purify. Give up. You know? So
it is every bug hunter's dream to get like a Dom Purify bypass.
It is. That's on the the bug hunter bingo chart or whatever of like, all right, let me Dom Purify bypass, RCE, you know, 0 day that I can spray across.
Akamai WAF bypass.
Well, and also, so speaking of WAFs, we'll just jump down a little bit to the second to last item on the list here. So I was poking around on a target the other day, and I don't know why. I've seen this endpoint like 50 bajillion times, but the whole Cloudflare / CDN - CGI thing kind of stood out to me because it's like, okay, essentially what's happening here is, you've got Cloudflare in front, it's a WAF, and then that WAF needs to have some client-side resources so that it can do things like, enforce a CAPTCHA or something like that. Excuse me. And so what it does is it injects this endpoint / CDN - CGI on all of the, websites it protects. And then it hosts its own custom stuff there, like JS files and that sort of thing, logging endpoints and that sort of thing. So I was looking at this, and I'm like, wow, this is super weird. And I feel like if we can hack this, then we can hack like every website, because every website that has Cloudflare has this on in front of it. And so I started researching it, and there's like a documentation endpoint, man, so such hacker terminology there, dude. A documentation page on what this endpoint is. And essentially it lists five uses for this endpoint. It says, okay, you can hit / CDN CGI / trace, which one is super cool because it like kicks back information about your request, and it's in like text plain content type, but that could be helpful for something for sure. So there's that. There's JavaScript detection. That's the bot product thing that prevents botting. There's image transformations, which I was like, okay, now we're talking here. So there's ways that you can like do transforming of images and converting of images. And I went in here and it's like supported input formats, SVG. Supported output formats, SVG. And I was like, that's interesting. So I went in there and I was like poking around at it for a long time. And I was like, man, I wonder if there's any bugs here, any ways to bypass. And I was actually thinking like, okay, SVG, XML, like we just talked about the Dom Purify bypass. Let me see if I can like try some cool stuff with that. So I was like writing that out, wasn't working. And of course, who do I turn to? The master of Cloudflare, Mr. Ryota himself that we just talked about. and Ryota's like, oh yeah, I assessed that like, months ago. There's a super duper tight freaking CSP on it. And I was like, shoot. Mm. So I went there and I looked, and lo and behold, it's like default source none, which is like, what are you going to be able to do with that? And so the SVG endpoint might be a little bit of a dead end, but there's also a bunch of other things here. And there have been bugs found here before by the Portswigger team back in 2017. And then also by our boy Masato Kinugawa found a like global CSP bypass on any website that uses Cloudflare back in 2017. And I just haven't... I researched around and I haven't seen a bunch of research on this specific endpoint since 2017-ish time. So I feel like it's time to look at this again, because I feel like there could be some CSP bypasses here and at least, if not CSP bypasses, at least some cool gadgets that could be used to hack some stuff in some pretty niche circumstances. We just got to enumerate every single file that is, or every single endpoint that's under that /CDN CGI place.
Yeah, for sure. It's cool to see this tweet all the way back from August 2017. This is, I think, even before I started Bug Bounty, because I started in August of 2017 at like a live hacking event. So this is probably like a couple weeks before I even started doing Bug Bounty, but it's really cool to see just the sort of, you know.
Are you talking about the one from Masato?
Just like,
Yeah.
This tweet just being like, hey, by the way, here's like a Cloudflare CSP bypass that I found, like weird behavior. Yeah. And it reminds me a lot of this other link from Malloc on Twitter that was talking about these XSS that he found, where this CDN of the target of the program is like cdn.example.com or whatever, and that's explicitly out of scope. But while they were looking at in scope targets, they noticed that there was a lot of endpoints that would use a slash version of it, where they would go, you know, example.com/CDN /file.js or whatever. And because of that, by popping something on the CDN, by finding an available file that they could upload and essentially control, they were able to use that same path scheme to pull their attacker controlled file from the CDN directly and get an XSS on all these different domains. And that just reminds me so much of this CDN CGI endpoint, because it's very, very similar. I wonder if it might even have been.
It's real sketchy, man. And like it makes you think, like, okay, especially in this, I've seen this scenario a bunch of times where it's like, okay, they're reverse proxying to their CDN and like they're saying it's out of scope, but actually we can just upload any file that we've uploaded to the CDN. We can just access on any given host. I've seen that plenty of times before. So that's a great general principle. But also this concept of like reverse proxying to CDNs, you know, in the Cloudflare scenario, in this scenario that Malloc is talking about, it's sketchy, man. It's sketchy because, you know, CDNs, they're supposed to host content, you know, and if that content can be affected by other users, you're just letting people upload arbitrary content to be hosted potentially on any other website that uses that same CDN if there's a reverse proxy.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's really interesting. I mean, like, just that behavior in general, like the path routing to like subdomains and stuff is super weird. Like, that screams reverse proxy problems, secondary context problems, all sorts of weird things. So, you know, that's one of those things to keep an eye out for. Like, definitely, probably more than XSS, you could find a lot more.
It's a great point. Another thing that I've kind of seen with this format is like, what'll happen is sometimes these CDNs need to be are like signed URL protected or whatever, right? And you need to get a signed URL for anything. And but when you're accessing it via like a certain path on a website, it's just using like whatever God token or whatever that gives it access to that S3 bucket or whatever that backend is. And one, if you can cause some sort of error and get it to leak that token, then that's big bucks. But two, if you can just do a path traversal, if you can get the reverse proxy to normalize and hit a path traversal, it's a little bit tricky with S3 because S3 doesn't do traversals. But if you can figure out a way to get that to work and you can hit any endpoint without having to, you know, have a signed URL or auth associated with it, then a lot of times there's a lot of sensitive information you can leak as well.
Yeah, for sure. I love that token leaking thing, because we've seen that many times at live hacking events where it's not even like a crazy complex bug. It's almost like a stack trace. It's like
crazy.
You know, like the least suspecting thing that you would think to become like a super critical bug. But all it takes is that, you know, it's that one token or that one overprivileged method of access and an accidental error trace and it's GG.
I'll never forget this one time. Like, there was an endpoint that a couple people found that was allowing you to do some traversing and that sort of thing on a back-end host, and you could access files you weren't supposed to be able to access, and it was like very impactful. It was definitely, you know, a higher crit already. And then Noggly comes along And he just, I don't know, being the big brain boy he is, he like sticks a collaborator, you know, domain in there in like a spot that it doesn't make any sense to put it in, right? And somehow he gets a hit on that domain instead of on the actual like backend host. And then that you know, hit, the SSRF hit, you couldn't do like full read or anything, but that SSRF hit had the auth token for that back server attached to it. You use that auth token, log into that backend server, and you can just dump everything, which is so much more impactful because you didn't need to know the URL, you know, the path of the thing that we were trying to leak on the backend.
That's so interesting. Another place where I see this type of pattern a lot is mobile apps, actually, where a lot of times for mobile app authentication, right? Typically, it's not cookies. It's like an auth token or something like that, like a header, and they forget to add an auth check, and so they just add it, like they have it added at sort of a middleware level across the entire request HTTP client that they're using, and it'll just add it to every single, because they assume, oh, this is just going to all our trusted hosts. But if you can find a way to control the host, or you know, make it redirect or something like that, well, we've talked about redirects a little bit, but depending on how it's implemented,
it's a pain.
Yeah, that one still hurts a little bit. But a lot of the times it'll get added automatically, and all you have to do is be able to control the host, and you get a full account takeover because that auth token or that auth cookie or whatever is getting set on every single request. And all you have to do is be able to control where that request is going. Yeah, and it's GG.
That's big. It's almost like client-side path traversal. For the client side of the sense, mobile apps, right? Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Which we've also seen.
We have. So I don't know, man. I hate to, because it's helpful to categorize all these different things, you know, like client side path traversal and like, you know, SSRF and blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, it's like, look, if you could make something hit your server, you know, be aware of the context in which that can happen. You know, like that can happen in the browser, it can happen, you know, in the victim's browser, it can happen in the, you know, the mobile app or the server, and then just read everything, you know, about that request that you can possibly read. And look at all the hints, look at all the little tokens, look at all the cookies that are getting passed along, because there's a decent chance that something could be really sensitive there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Let's see. What do we got?
I want you to talk about XSS Doctor, because there was some really awesome collaboration that happened in the Critical Thinkers channel on the Discord, and it led to a blog post and a couple other things. So why don't you talk about
XSS Doctor was such a valued member of the critical thinking community. Was chatting in the Critical Thinkers chat on the Discord, and he was talking about, he's like, oh guys, I found this like really cool way to like reverse JavaScript. JavaScript obfuscation. And I was like, dude, you got to write this up. Like, this is helpful for somebody. This is exactly what we talk about on the pod all the time, which is like, look, even if it isn't a crazy vuln, if you spent some time and you figured something out, then, and you're so inclined, you know, I'm not going to tell everybody to write up everything, but like, and you're so inclined, write that up. It has a lot of value to share things like that, because you know, people can build on the back of that, just like we saw with the .NET remoting thing, how, you know, the Code White team built on the on the back of Sarouche, and then they built on their own stuff, and it keeps on building and building and building, and the more we can sort of help foster that environment, it's really good. So I said, listen, JD, you gotta write this up. So he wrote it up. And he's got it posted on Medium. We'll link it down in the description. But essentially, what he did was he released a script and sort of explained what was going on with a very common JS obfuscation scheme. And essentially what it is they, those jerks, take all the strings, everything helpful from a JavaScript file, and they just stick it in one massive array, right? And then they say to themselves, okay, how can I make this shit as complicated as possible? and so they make this like decryption function that's like, okay, we're going to take in a hex value, not a decimal value, a hex value, just to be a little shit. And then we're going to do a certain amount of like shifts and pushes, you know, to like rotate the order of this array this many times. And then we're going to do some math, and then we're going to like, you know, spit out a value from this array, and that's the thing you're looking for, you know, in this sort of obfuscation scheme.
Yeah.
And so essentially JD very painstakingly stepped through all of that, explained how all of this works and how common of a JS obfuscation scheme this is, a sort of format this is. And he includes a script on how to unobfuscate scripts that use this method. And he showed me the results of the before and after of the script, and man, does it increase readability in these sort of super obfuscated situations. So I think this is really helpful for anybody who's dealing with highly obfuscated JS.
Yeah, and I love the sort of the basic, simple knowledge sharing aspect that you talked about. I mean, like, we do that. I mean, that's half what this podcast is, just like us talking about like random little things and tips and tricks and stuff that we've come across and learned throughout the years of doing bug bounty, and having, you know, other people just sort of write those things down and share it is so valuable, because the same people who are listening to this podcast also want to consume that data, right? They want those little tips and tricks that they can put in their notebook or put in the back of their head. And then when they encounter something like that, they can say, oh, I have a thing for that. Let me go, you know, I don't need to waste my time figuring out how this works. Let me just read that XSS Doctor blog post really quick and do the same thing and make this easier and cut to the chase. The other thing is, I see this all the time, again, in mobile apps. Mobile apps do this all the time with string obfuscation. And I imagine you could probably do a similar thing in JavaScript. What I like to do in Android is I just use Frida, and I hook and I call the function directly, and I just pass in the obfuscated string that I have in the source code. And I'll just, you know, take the decoded or decrypted output or whatever, and I'll just replace it in the source so that I can know what it is. The other thing I'll sometimes do is I'll hook it, and I'll either replace the function with like a wrapper or something like that, and I'll just log all the inputs and outputs and say, oh, this obfuscated input equals this deobfuscated output. And then either I can do a match and replace throughout my entire source, and I can replace all the instances of it, or if I'm, you know, I come across something encrypted, instead of having to run that function manually, I can just control F for it in the output of, you know, my console or whatever, and I can see
the wrapper is a good idea. And he mentioned something in there too. It's like, okay, so this function is called, you know, A3C or whatever, right? And sometimes they call it A3C directly, but sometimes they'll do like let CD equal A3C, and then they'll call CD or something like that. And it's like, come on, could you please not do that?
Yeah, exactly. So that's the one thing about the wrapper, right? The wrapper, if you wrap that underlying function, then regardless of how it gets called, then it's still going to log it. So that's pretty nice. But yeah, obfuscation is always just, it's one of those security through obscurity things that I never really agree with, because it, like, what is it doing? It's making it more difficult to understand what's going on from an outside perspective, but there's no actual like security implications there, right? Like, you're not making it from a backend side. Like, if you're trying to prevent somebody from abusing your APIs, then prevent them from abusing your APIs from the API side, right? Add server-side checks, add additional verification methods, all sorts of stuff that make it more difficult to abuse the APIs. Don't just make it more difficult to read. But maybe that's my naive.
No. I mean, approach. Like, look, dude, I want to agree with you. And don't get me wrong, in a report, many times I have dissed security by absurdity and be like, you can't rely on security by obscurity, you know, like very passionately arguing for security or against security by obscurity. But recently I'm realizing, like, listen, so much of this industry, you know, at its core is just about not being the easiest target to pop. Right? You know, like,
that's true.
Like, and I think most of the people that are running bug bounty programs are already kind of beyond that point, I'd imagine, you know, where it's like, they're not the easiest, you know, one to get into or whatever, but, just riddle me this, Joel, you know, riddle me this, Joel, if you're hacking a target and you put one wrong parameter and it returns a 404, how does that make you feel? That makes you feel terrible, doesn't it? When there's no error page,
it's certainly not a good
404,
feeling.
You know, there's no 500 error, there's no 400, there's no like 403. Am I not authorized? Who knows? It's just a 404, you know? Yeah.
How about wild card subdomains?
Dude, I hate that shit, man. And so it's like, you know, anything you can do like that, you know, JS obfuscation, 404, you know, error pages and stuff like that, rather than actual 500s or whatever, or 403s even, right? Like, yeah. when you do a 403, you're letting the attacker know, hey, you're not authorized to do this, you know? And that gives them information where you could just say,
yeah,
don't know, you know? And so...
Do you think that there's a remedy for this from like to make it easier for security researchers though? Because like on one hand, like for attackers, like, yeah, it's dangerous to not have those things in place when like someone's coming from a malicious intent perspective. But then if you have sort of that best intent perspective and you want to make it easier for researchers, like do you have any tips? Yeah, any ideas?
Like I said, best intent, not good intent. You know, normally the phrase is like good intent security research, but we have the best intent. So I think pretty much the only solution to that from this perspective is like having a private VIP program. If you're a public program, because if you're a public program, you can't release to everyone like, hey, just add this header and it'll like turn all the 404s into 500s or whatever, right?
Yeah, that's crazy. Because
then, you know, the hackers are just going to be like, thank you very much, you know?
I am a security researcher, that's right.
I have lost my way. But yeah, if you run a private VIP program with the people that are going to be adding the most value to your program with vetted, you know, people on it, you know, HackerOne background checked or whatever, and have a track record of being, you know, best intent security researchers, then
not just good, but the best.
good faith security researchers. That's the term. Best faith security researchers. I'm gonna put that in my Twitter bio now. Best faith security researcher.
I'm not even good. I'm just the best.
Yeah. So anyway, then you can release, you know, some sort of header or something that's going to undo all that. And you can release, you know, unobfuscated JS files and stuff like that. So I don't know, man, it's a little bit of a trade-off. Obviously all of that takes time and effort away from actually securing the product as well. Right. Because at the end of the day, it's not that hard to sort of intuit how some of this functionality is going to be working. You know, if there's like an ID parameter and the ID parameter, you know, equals, you know, somebody's ID, and then you put in somebody else's ID. If it's not a 403, it's a 200, then you have to return a 200. You know, at the end of the day, you're still going to run into issues like that. So whether it's worth it or not, I'm not sure, but it definitely pisses me off. So I imagine it'd piss off other hackers too.
Me too. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, we have two more tweets, and I wanted to save Naffy's for the end to discuss that. So let's go over Rennie Pox. Cool little technique here. I think this is just one of those little gadgets for like proving impact. I think that's just a nice little
I wanted to ask you about this, Joel, because so Renipack tweeted, to make your XSS less conspicuous, you can hide your payload by updating the URL path with a valid URL. And I think this is just something a lot of people don't know you can do. So if you run history.pushState and then as a third parameter provide a path, it will stay on the same page that you're on. You know, like you will remain in control of the DOM. But the path will be updated. The path in the URL bar will be updated to whatever you provided. And that's just pretty weird.
Yeah, for sure. And you see this actually on a lot of websites without probably even realizing it. Basically, anything that's changing your URL without a full page load or a redirect is doing this. I think YouTube does this a lot.
This is how all the single page applications work.
Yeah, all the single page applications are using, you know, push... local string push history or whatever, push state, whatever the function is.
Yeah, I don't know. I wanted to talk to you about this. Like, one, I think a great tweet, really helpful, brings light to something that a lot of people might not be aware of being possible. But also, like, I feel like there's a whole set of like attacker-like practices like this that you can implement into your POCs that just bring more impact. And what I've realized lately is like when you model a full attack path and you make it extremely clear, That hits harder with the team. I have a bug that recently got paid 150% of what it normally would get paid, because we found a bug similar to this many times. And, you know, we submit it. They always pay the same amount for it every time. But this time I was like, all right, let me take this a little bit further. I'm going to explain how I would distribute this payload, given, you know, the functionality on the website. I'm going to explain how I would exploit this once the user, you know, clicks on the link or whatever, and how, you know, how I would worm it, essentially. So I described that, and it got paid 150% what it normally gets paid. So I think there's this whole concept of like making your attacks have more visual impact that I think is a little bit underestimated, and I might have been, and I do pretty good POCs, and like I that's what I, something that I consider to be one of my strong points. But I think you can even take it even further and describe the whole attack path, and how you would exploit this at a scale, and I think that will really increase impact.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it really depends on the program, right? So some programs are really good about saying, like, we know what impact is, like, we can tell that from this point, here's what the ultimate impact would be of your vulnerability, we're going to pay it out as such. However, I would say that's not the norm. Most programs probably aren't going to do that. Most programs are going to say, here's the impact you demonstrated, we're going to pay you as such. You know, if you have an XSS, but you don't show that you can steal cookies and do an ATO, they're going to pay it as an XSS, not an ATO, right? Because, I mean, for a lot of reasons, right? Like, it's not really in their best interest to escalate a vulnerability for you, right? Like, even further, like, they probably know that issue is there. But, you know, from the researcher's perspective, you want to sort of demonstrate the highest impact you can. So that is also sort of that benefit of hacking on one program, is that you develop those gadgets and those impact scenarios yourself, where you can say, oh, anytime I have an XSS, I can create an ATO, like they have this systemic problem or whatever it is. And you can demonstrate that impact. In other cases, it might not, you know, be worth it, right? Like, for the time and effort or whatever it takes to escalate that vulnerability further, like, versus just like having, you know, if you know the program and you know that they're going to handle it well, spending an extra 4 hours or something try and escalate your XSS to some, you know, further bug may not be worth the effort, right? Is the juice worth the squeeze, is the phrase that I always like. And so I think it, you know, it kind of depends program by program, but you should always try and, you know, if you have the ability to put a higher impact scenario, I mean, imagine, right? Like, if you have an XSS and you have an ATO, why would you only report the XSS, right? You're always going to report the higher impact scenario. So if you have those easy opportunities, if you have those easy opportunities, like, chase them down, you know, hedge your time and stuff so that you're not spending too much time on something that's not worth it. But, you know, escalate your bugs as best as you can, and then when you feel like you're there, go ahead and submit it. And that's always my recommendation. Man,
but not, this is something Nagli does well, which just ekes me a little bit.
Oh yeah, 100%.
Freaking ekes me a little bit, man. Because like, whenever we collab, he's like, Justin, why aren't you writing a good report? What, you need to write a better report for them to like.
His title is like pre-auth full RCE access to source code, and it's like XSS. And you're like,
you
wait.
Know, like, and he does take it a little over the top sometimes, but he tells a good story, you know, and he outlines the attack path. So, and I think what Ranipak did here was like, he provided another way for you to make it seem more like an actual attack. And, you know, if you look in your URL bar and there's like, you know, script, blah, 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 you know, then it might not be the most, you know, convincing attack. But if you update that using history.pushState, then it can make something look very benign. And, you know, people could not even realize they're on a certain page. So it's definitely a good technique, and there's other things as well, like closing your sort of conspicuous windows after you do CSERFs with them, and not just leaving it open on the, like, you know, company's successfully updated object page or whatever.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. And I think, just like I said before, it just feels good to give a fully polished POC, and I think For those of you that haven't fully fleshed out like a banger of a POC before, you should give it a shot, because it feels amazing to submit that report and see your work sort of manifest before you.
Yeah. And also from the program side, it's it's really nice when you can just like click one link and see the full impact there, right? Like when a researcher says step one, click this link, step two, ATO, like that's awesome, right? And so like both the satisfaction for you as well as the program of like, there's no question in anybody's mind what the impact is here, what the bug is here. Like it is very, very clear that this is a vulnerability and that it's exploitable and that it has impact. And that's just going to make your triage process faster. It's going to make the payout process faster. It's going to make your experience communicating with the program team faster and easier and better. Like everything's just better. So if you have a banger POC,
do it.
Do it. Like do it. Make it as good as you can and always put out the best POC you can, because and like the flip side, the converse is you create a POC that's like lackluster and there's like 10, 15 steps. You're going to be going back and forth with triage, trying to get them to reproduce it. You're going to be going back and forth with the program, trying to get them to understand the impact and how it works. Like it make everybody's life easier, your own included, and put a great POC together. That's my recommendation.
Sure, dude. So where do we want to go with the Nafi's tweet? You want to launch that one off or should I launch that one off?
Sure. Well, I'll read it and then I know you had a question about it. So Nafi made a tweet. This was a week ago. And he said, I think the idea of keeping it simple is especially true for web testing. Long before you start trying to implement complex techniques, you need to get down the basics of one, what are the assets? Recon, subdomains, IP ranges. Two, what can I see on those assets? Brute forcing, are they APIs? How are they reached? Is it brute forcible? Etc. When Nafi first started hacking, Yahoo's all that he used to do. He would run Nmap and dir search for days and find random ass directories that were old legacy apps and hack on those apps. And he says that there's nothing wrong with the complexity, but I have largely remained immune to the movements of application security. This is the most significant thing I think I've added to my methodology for the last years is checking for secondary context traversals. If you're doing just those two things well with any kind of volume or repetition, you should be finding things. I know that I still do, and I'm largely doing the same things.
Yeah, so, dude. So like,
go ahead.
This is not where I thought he was going with this tweet, right? If you read it in the beginning, he says, and this is where the tweet cuts off, right? He says, long before you start trying to implement complex techniques, you need to get down the basics of, and then the tweet cuts, right? And it goes to like the next tweet. I was like, okay, all right, Nafi, like you tell him. And then I clicked into that tweet and he's like, recon. And I'm like, okay, I see that. And I know that Nafi's a really like recon heavy dude, and he does, and man, is he like one of the most talented recon guys out there. Like he really just, I saw him, I worked with him a little bit on a live hacking event once on an older company, specifically on an older company. And he's just like really, really coming up with good stuff. And I think recon is important, understanding, you know, what assets there are to attack. But I think before you do all that, you know, you need to get down the basics of hacking. You know, you need to get down the basics of like, okay, once I find these assets, what am I going to do with them? And like, how do I find an XSS? How do I find an access control thing? I think there's very clearly multiple types of hackers, even more so than I used to think so. And the results are really excellent for both. You know, like you get the J Haddix and the Nafi type, where they're really just like going heavy on the recon, going heavy on the scanning, going heavy on this on the you know, brute forcing the directories and that sort of thing, finding all the APIs. I like how Nafi called out APIs here. Are there APIs? How are they reached? How are they accessible? That's a good call out. But there's those kind of people, and then there's the people that are, you know, working on the business logic of the applications. And I just feel like working on the business logic of the applications is a better place to start. What do you think about that?
Yeah, for sure. What I liked about this, like I read this and I pulled sort of different conclusions that Nafi did from his own tweet, right? So Nafi was like, oh, you should like do recon, like figure out the assets, like, are they brute forcible and stuff? Like, yeah, like kind of, but that's the recon approach, right? And I think if you're Nafi and you hunt like Nafi, that is the right place to approach it. That is the right way. And I also think Nafi's oversimplifying his own process by saying, you know, like, oh, is this brute forcible? Are there patterns? Like that takes decades of context and experience that Nafi has that makes it really, really easy for him to do that. And he does that really well because of that. So when he looks at an API and he goes, oh, there's like a weird pattern here, like that clicks for him immediately. That's not going to click for everybody immediately. When you see sort of these routing things, that just is from years and years and years of him looking at different APIs, especially legacy ones, right? The stuff that he's really good at hacking on, and identifying those common patterns and being able to exploit them really efficiently.
Yeah.
What I like about his tweet is the keep it simple aspect, right? And I think a lot of time, myself included, when I'm approaching a target, I way overcomplicate my like hacking methodology. Like I'm trying way outside the box techniques. I'm trying all these crazy edge case, like, oh, maybe this is possible. Maybe this is possible. Let me try this crazy thing. That is fine sometimes, and a lot of times that will end up being a bug, but it's a lot more sort of like shot in the dark than it needs to be. And I like that concept of keeping it simple and identifying what you're dealing with, like what are the assets, same thing but more like web application, like, so what are the parameters, what are the technologies, is it JSON, is That's it XML, is it web-based? The APIs thing still applies, right? Are there APIs? Great question. Can you brute force it? Is there a WAF? How does it handle when you give it an array instead of a string? Like all these types of different things, understanding the different pieces. And we've talked about this, like as you go deep on a target, you build out sort of a mental mesh or map of what the target is, how it works, the different pieces that connect to each other and what things talk to what and how data travels from one part of the application to another part of the application. And I think that is potentially more useful than doing sort of that. Like the recon approach is almost completely separate, but different, right? It's the same, but different, where yes, you're understanding the basics from like a architecture level versus you're understanding the basics from an application level. And I think like keeping it simple and just understanding the fundamentals of what you're hacking on is good regardless of how you're doing it, whether that's figuring out how the routing is working from a DNS level or figuring out how the routing is working from a path level.
You know, this is a deep one, dude. You know, because there's a couple things here. Like you mentioned, there's this whole concept of recon within the main app too. You know, understanding where the APIs are in the main app, where, you know, how data flows, how the JS looks. Like there's internal recon as well, app internal recon, that I think is very important, and applying those same principles of what Nafi does here as a recon hacker, as a wide scale recon hacker to hacking inside an application. Those concepts are very applicable. Where are the paths? Where what parameters are they taking? Just like you said, I really like that. That's really good. The other thing that's kind of struck me as I'm talking about this is like, maybe I'm playing it safe. Maybe the reason why I like hacking the main app is because there's always functionality there. There's always impact there. And that's for certain. Whereas with recon, it kind of feels like a big question mark to me. You know, it's like, am I going to find an asset? Okay, is that asset going to have anything that I can touch on it? You know, like without auth, or can I figure out a way to auth into it? You know, okay, is there any functionality on this weird host in the middle of nowhere? You know, can I guess the parameters? Can I guess the path? You know, it's just there's so many question marks for me. But you do see people like Nafi and Shubs pop these in Corbin for that matter, pop these crazy crits. Because they find some backend admin host that has no auth. And those kind of crits are not crits, to be perfectly honest, that I run across ever. Because I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, man. I'm gonna put some more thought into that from a hacker perspective, because it kind of reminds me of the whole salary man is not the word in English. That's a Japanese word, but it's like, you know, the traditionally employed, the W-2 employee versus the entrepreneur, right? It's like, there's so many questions. There's so much uncertainty. There's so much struggle that goes into the entrepreneur life, versus this really stable, really consistent, always going to have your bills paid money that comes from a W-2. But for me, the trade-off has been great. you know, I've loved it. I've been able to push that uncertainty and really enjoy being an entrepreneur or a self-employed. So maybe, and it kind of, do you see the parallel that I'm trying to make there between like,
Yeah, I totally see the parallel. I think like for recon, the interesting thing about recon is, the interesting thing about recon is it's not like one, almost every recon bug I found has been basically entirely separated from the main app in terms of like not always impact, but like what it's actually, what I'm finding there. Like a lot of the times when I'm doing recon, it is some random system that does some random weird functionality that shouldn't exist or shouldn't be exposed. And I'm not really understanding like the core API or the core web app that maybe is using that service somewhere along the way or whatever. Like I'm just seeing, oh, this is a weird service. I can exploit it in this way. Here's a vulnerability. And that's very different from like, hey, on your main web app, there's an XSS that leads to account takeover, right? That's very specific, like application level, user level type functionality vulnerabilities versus almost configuration vulnerabilities. So they're very like different buckets, but they apply to each other very similarly, where, you know, it's the same thing of like, you want to understand what you're looking at and you want to be able to like identify like, oh, this is a weird target. Like, why does this domain return a blank page instead of a 404 or something like that? And digging into that and identifying where to go from a blank page for a lot of people can be a lot more difficult than just logging into the web app and clicking all the buttons and finding, you know, some endpoint within the JS or some functionality within the client side that is vulnerable. So I think it's just a very different skill set. And it's like when you go to the gym and you do legs versus arms, like it's just a different muscle group. And, you know, you can be super jacked on your arms and stuff, and then you got little twig legs.
Yeah.
I built a home gym recently, and I'm struggling.
No, it's good to see you going after that. Yeah, man, I tend to agree. You know, I think it's just different muscle groups, but it's definitely food for thought. Of like, I wonder if I'm being intimidated out of the recon game because of the levels of uncertainty. But at the end of the day, there's uncertainty with the main app too, of like, is there going to be anything to find there? But at least the functionality is there, right? And that's what I kind of like. The guarantee that the functionality will be there, and that there's going to be something for me to work with. Whereas, you know, in recon, there's no guarantees about whether there will be something to work with or not. So.
Yep. And even with recon, it's not all the same. Like there's like the recon that Nagli does and like Mochan does, and then there's the recon that like Nafi does or JHaddix does, where like for JHaddix and Nafi, that recon is to find new assets. For Nagli and Mochan, that recon is to exploit vulnerabilities, like ready vulnerabilities, right? And they have like nuclei templates and stuff like that are like looking for specific things to pop on these hosts. Whereas I think when Nafi finds a host that looks interesting, he like dives in on it and like goes everywhere just trying to find some sort of entry point or some sort of thing. He's not looking for like, is this running Spring Boot? Can I you know, execute this specific CVE, right? It's a bit of a different process, even within just like the recon sphere.
It is. So, yeah, there's definitely a difference.
But going deep as a whole, like go deep for sure. Keep it simple, go deep, and understand what you're looking
at. That's a great way to end it, man.